and definitional issues will sometimes be crucial. But most world historians use at least something of the following framework, although they may break it down in greater detail depending on how much time they have for their subject matter. We will be, over time, looking primarily at seven civilizational/geographic areas. East Asia, certainly. South and Southeast Asia, and sometimes we can deal with them as a whole. Sometimes we'll need to emphasize some subdivisions. Third, the Middle East, and ultimately the Middle East and North Africa, though that's not a combination that emerged right away. Fourth, Eastern Europe. Fifth, Western Europe. Sixth, Sub-Saharan Africa. And seventh, what ultimately became the newest of the major civilization areas, Latin America. This leaves a few parts of the world out, most obviously North America and Pacific Oceania, and we'll have to talk later about how we put these regions into a civilizational map. But this at least can help get us started. A final definitional point is really very specific, and I almost apologize for it, but I think it has to be mentioned. World historians in the United States use BCE and CE as their main chronological divides. They add up to the same things as BC and AD, but BCE stands for before the Common Era, CE for the Common Era. It's the same dating, but the argument is that since this is a world history dealing with a large number of religious traditions, to use specifically Christian designations just doesn't quite fit. Now, this terminological nicety, it's clearly an example of political correctness, may be a bit annoying. I know that some people think it's sort of silly, but I will be using it because it's a convention in world history and I don't want to get kicked out of the craft, and also because it does usefully remind us, and here's the one valid, clearly valid element of it. It does usefully remind us that as we turn to world history, we are really taking a step that differs from the Western-focused history that many of us were exposed to in our own educations. All of us, at least at my age and even a bit younger, all of us who do world history are converts. We were not trained in world history. We picked it up because we thought that this was an important new vantage point for the reasons I already indicated, important particularly because of its role in helping to prepare American students and a wider public for the global framework within which our society now operates on and on which our society has impact. If you don't know world history, I think it's fair to argue you may not be as well prepared to handle world issues at the present as you should be, just as in earlier decades in the 20th century, you could make the valid argument that if you didn't know Western history, you would not be as well prepared to deal with the issues the United States faced in relationships to Western Europe as you should be. Our world has shifted, and therefore the history we need has shifted as well. Let me end with a very specific point. I mentioned earlier that conventionally world historians end one period around 1450 CE and then pick up the early modern period. 1450 will, in some ways, seem pretty familiar to those of us trained in Western history. It has some relationship to the Renaissance, the Reformation is looming, and these things actually are relevant. But 1450 is a date in world history much more obviously, because it begins to introduce some key changes in the Middle East, North Africa, some key changes in Russia and Eastern Europe, some key changes looming soon in the relationship between the Americas and the rest of the world, and through this, many of the products and trade routes that would affect virtually every society in the world. And only as part of this wider scheme are the developments in Western Europe specifically to be fit. World history periodization will not always seem totally unfamiliar in the dates used, but it will, I hope, seem quite different from what we're used to in a Western framework when we get into the reasons for the choice and the basic factors to be explored. Welcome to the World History Train. Our next stop will be the rise of agriculture.
Lecture 2, The Neolithic Revolution.
This session focuses on the rise of agriculture in human history and uses it as a focal point for developments prior to that that we need to know, but also particularly as a framework for developments that will occur after agriculture is introduced. Now, this is a choice. I mentioned in the previous lecture that world historians often are eager to find earlier origins, and that can involve pushing back the attention well before agriculture. David Christian, in his fascinating book, Maps of Time, spends about a third of the book before he gets to the emergence of any version of the human species at all. So he integrates world history with the evolution of the Earth itself, and this is fine. Obviously, also, you can spend an immense amount of time, and many people do, on the early developments of the species, and these nuances obviously fade if you focus, as I do, on agriculture as the first cut. But choices have to be made, and I think this gets us off to a satisfactory start. Agriculture began to be introduced to the human experience around 9000 BCE, and I'll come back to these dates in a moment. Prior to that time, from the emergence of the human species, say 2.5 million years ago, though the date keeps getting pushed back as new discoveries are made, from about 2.5 million years ago until about 11,000 years ago, the human species was involved in hunting and gathering economies, in which, for the most part, males of the species would participate in hunts, and females would be responsible for gathering seeds and grains, often generating more caloric value than the more boastful men did in the process. This long period between the early emergence of the species and the rise of agriculture raises, I think, three important points that even in our shorthand version need some attention. First of all, obviously, is the fact of evolution itself, not as a debating point, but simply as an understanding that between 2.5 million years ago, or a little earlier, and about 100,000 years ago, the human species went through a variety of evolutionary phases in a number of different parts of the world. The species originated in East Africa. Early on, the species, early versions of the species migrated to different parts of the world. A large number of human species were generated over time. Most of them disappeared well before the emergence of Homo sapiens sapiens because of adverse conditions, competition from other species. We obviously don't always know why. But about 100,000 years ago, Homo sapiens sapiens emerged. That is the species to which we all belong. And from that point onward, which included, by the way, soon thereafter, the introduction of what some sociobiologists call the speech gene, which greatly facilitated human speech compared to earlier versions and therefore facilitated the emergence of more formally organized human societies, etc. From that point onward, there have been no major evolutionary changes in the human experience. Sociobiologists would quarrel with this a little bit. There have certainly been some developments, but we remain the same basic species that emerged in East Africa also about 100,000 years ago. So world history that begins with the emergence of agriculture obviously doesn't pay a lot of attention to the niceties of the evolutionary experience, but this looms as an important background. Second datum, and very familiar to those of us who had brief grade school exposure to some version of world history, it became pretty clear early on that the human species, well before the emergence of Homo sapiens sapiens, was a tool-using animal. It's not the only species that uses tools. Some of the great apes do. But the human species became particularly adept initially at finding tools that would be suitable for hunting or for gathering or whatever, or as weapons of war. And ultimately, particularly with the Mesolithic and the Neolithic eras, 12,000 BCE and then around 8,000 BCE, tool use became increasingly deliberate. In other words, instead of simply finding tools, people became capable of making them, fashioning rocks, fashioning wood objects to make better weapons, better tools, even primitive boats. And they also, as part of this tool use, or at least I think it's a logical extension, began to be capable of domesticating certain kinds of animals, initially the dog, and before the advent of agriculture, also some other species, including in some parts of the world, the horse. So evolution, but evolution that produced Homo sapiens sapiens and then, at least for a time, tapered off in terms of severe impact. Tool use, these are points, obviously, that set a framework for the emergence of agriculture itself, help us better understand the species whose history we're studying. The third pre-agricultural development is, in some ways, particularly crucial to world history, and that is the massive experience of migration. Homo sapiens sapiens, again, originated in East Africa, but after some thousands of years, began to pour out into other regions and ultimately around the world, as had earlier versions of the species as well. The reasons for migration were very simple. Hunting and gathering societies require a lot of space. It's been estimated, obviously depends a bit on the region, on an average they need 2.5 square miles per person. So even a modest population growth will force a group of hunter-gatherers to move a little farther to seek new space. And ultimately, this process extends so that the species will push out of the region altogether into other parts of the world. By 25,000 BCE, in other words, just 27,000 years ago, the species Homo sapiens sapiens had located in virtually every place in the world that is currently inhabited. Exceptions include, at that point, New Zealand, some of the other Pacific islands, Bermuda, but otherwise the species was in small numbers almost everywhere. It had crossed to Australia. At the point when it did so, the landmass in Southeast Asia extended much closer to what is now Australia, much farther into the Indian Ocean than is now the case, so the sea passage was relatively modest. As is more familiar still, people crossed into the Americas around over an ice bridge that connected Siberia with Alaska. This occurred earlier than had been originally estimated. Seems to have occurred at least 25,000 years ago, maybe earlier than that. But again, by 25,000 years ago, there were peoples in the Americas. There were obviously peoples in Africa where the species originated. People spread throughout much of Asia, in Australia, Europe, etc. Okay? This means that human history begins at a point when the species is widely dispersed. I mentioned in my earlier lecture, one of the key tensions in world history is the balance between the local and the connected. Well, we begin with the pretty local. People were spread out in small numbers and inevitably reacting to local environmental conditions, reacting to accident, formed intensely important local cultures, local institutions, and this would set the basis for the local, the more regional aspect of the human identity, which again remains important today. Now, the local shouldn't be overdone. There were language groupings that united people in larger elements, lots and lots of different specific languages, but a far smaller number of basic language groupings. And that's a connection that obviously we need to remember that modifies the local. But the species begins extremely dispersed. About 12,000 years ago, roughly 9,000 BCE, there were at most 5 to 10 million people in the world as a whole. Very small number, very widely dispersed, and that's sort of the framework within which agriculture was introduced. There are a couple of other ingredients that could be added to the story. One of the things that's been particularly interesting as we talk about both migration and evolution, and to some extent even tool use, is the debate about how different species interacted, different human species interacted in the process before Homo sapiens sapiens emerged triumphant. It turns out that Homo sapiens sapiens coexisted with other human species like Neanderthals for a longer period than we realized. Their advantage over Neanderthals may have had less to do with brain capacity, which is what Homo sapiens sapiens came to pride itself on, than actually with running ability. Neanderthals were excellent at long-distance, slow running, which was terrific when the issue at hand was the hunting of large game. When the issue shifted more to smaller animals that were swifter, Homo sapiens sapiens had a clear advantage. We still don't know the extent to which Homo sapiens sapiens simply outcompeted other species like Neanderthals, clubbed them to death. The species obviously was violent from the outset, or intermarried with them. Some of you may have more Neanderthal in you than you recognized. It's an interesting process and simply serves as an illustration of the complexity of some of the developments that prefigured agriculture. Okay, agriculture. Want to talk here about when it was introduced, the complexities of its introduction, because unfortunately human species did not do this in a tidy fashion, the implications for the future, and the implications about what kind of attitude one takes to major historical developments of this sort. There's no question, first point, that the introduction of agriculture, what is sometimes called the Neolithic Revolution, was one of the key changes in the human experience. Some would argue one of literally the two key changes other than the emergence of the species itself, the other one being the replacement of agricultural economies with industrial economies. Whether that degree of emphasis is justified or not, this is a big deal change, and one of our tasks today is to talk about why it's such a big deal. Okay, agriculture was invented at least three different places separately, and probably more. The first invention occurred in the northern Middle East Black Sea region, associated with the domestication of wheat and barley. It probably occurred there because of changes in animal supply. Agriculture was almost certainly, though of course we don't know this for sure, was almost certainly introduced by women because as gatherers they had been the ones who probably noticed, well, if you dropped some seeds in the ground, a little later something else happened. This may have been a mistake on their part, as we'll discuss later, but they were almost certainly responsible for the development initially. The second invention of agriculture was around rice. Occurred in South China and the continental part of Southeast Asia, about 7,000 BCE. The third clear separate invention was the domestication of corn or maize in Central America, beginning about 5,000 BCE. And there were probably other separate inventions. Probably agriculture was separately invented in sub-Saharan Africa, possibly also in northern China. We simply don't know, but at least there were three separate cases at widely dispersed intervals. So again, this is not a chronologically tidy development. We can talk about the emergence of agricultural society from about 9,000 BC onward, but we have to recognize that this was true only in some parts of the world. Everywhere when agriculture was introduced, it gradually spread, and ultimately, certainly by 5,000 BCE, was becoming the most common economic system for the largest number of people in the world. But, 2 points. One, it did not spread as rapidly as we might imagine, given the presumed advantages that this system had over hunting and gathering, advantages that we will make clearer a little later on. It spread slowly because contacts among peoples, although they did exist, contacts were themselves gradual, and there were simply long periods of time in which agriculture could be flourishing in one region, another region as close as 1,000, 1,500 miles away would simply be totally unaware of it. The spread of agriculture, for example, from the northern Middle East into northwestern Europe, the distances are not inconsiderable, but they're also not immense. This took literally thousands and thousands of years. So slowness of diffusion is a factor. Second, equally important, not all regions were equally suitable for agriculture, either temporarily or permanently. They might be particularly heavily forested. They might be arid. All sorts of factors might induce a people either to delay their adoption of agriculture or simply to avoid it altogether, at least until the modern period. Particularly important are cases in which hunting and gathering economies persisted, but even more important still, cases in which an alternative economic system based on herding domesticated animals, a nomadic economic system, long prevailed over any introduction of agriculture. Nomadic societies were particularly important in the Middle East, in Africa, in some parts of the Americas, but above all in Central Asia, where they will play a crucial recurrent role in world history, as we will see later on. So, two obvious points. Despite the importance of agriculture, which I'm going to return to momentarily, agriculture did not conquer the whole world, and agriculture spread more slowly than we might imagine, partly because of lack of knowledge, partly because of particular climatic and soil conditions, but also partly because there were actually some pretty good reasons that peoples might not want to adopt agriculture. Agriculture, for example, for the most part, involves settling down. Hunting and gathering people might treasure their capacity to move around. There is one version of agriculture, slash and burn, that allows people to farm for a couple years and then move on, but it's not the dominant form. Agriculture might seem repellent to societies in which males were accustomed to boasting about their hunting exploits. So there could be gender reasons for delaying, if not avoiding, agriculture altogether. We do not know the debates that must have occurred in groups and among individuals as the agricultural alternative presented itself as to whether they should adopt it or not. Ultimately, obviously, agriculture would prevail in most of the world where it's possible at all, and certainly in the largest population concentrations, but it was not an automatic or uniform choice, which is a caution about oversimplifying the agricultural story. When agriculture was introduced, it involved really massive changes in the human experience. First, it changed the nature of work, and here the change is counterintuitive. Agriculture involves more work, particularly for men, in most cases, than hunting and gathering does. It's been estimated that hunting and gathering, on average, it'll be varied depending on the intensity of the hunt. Hunting and gathering involves about 3 hours of work per day. Agriculture, in season, involved much, much more. So agriculture redefines and, on the whole, increases the work expectations of human society. Agriculture massively redefined gender relations. In most hunting and gathering societies, as noted, men did the hunting, women did the bulk of the gathering, but because both groups contributed extensively to the food supply, women were usually given a reasonably prestigious place. It was separate from men, maybe a little inferior, but in many hunting and gathering societies, they participated in governing decisions. They were not treated as a systematically inferior part of the human species, despite the fact that our images of cavemen frequently emphasize club-wielding men lording it over women. Those images are inaccurate. In agricultural societies, however, patriarchal systems came to predominate everywhere. As we'll see, they might take different specific forms, but all agricultural societies introduced male dominance over women, older male dominance over younger males. And this became a characteristic of agricultural societies that still affects the human experience even several centuries past agricultural predominance. Why did this happen? The most obvious reason was that agriculture both permitted and required an expansion of the birth rate. With more secure food supplies, and that's the crucial advantage of agriculture over hunting and gathering, agriculture does not guarantee adequacy. Agricultural societies would experience periodic famines, grain failure, crop failures, etc. But agriculture does produce more abundant and more predictable food supplies than hunting and gathering does, and that permits larger numbers of children to be born. Quite literally, in agricultural societies, women deliberately limited their lactation period, during which it's difficult, though not impossible, to conceive a new child. In hunting and gathering societies, women actually breastfed their children for upwards of 3 to 5 years. This was both to provide food supply for young children in a society in which food could otherwise be scarce, and was designed to limit the birth rate, because hunting and gathering societies simply could not afford too many children. They moved around too many young children, would be a burden, etc. In agriculture, the greater abundance of food, without overdoing that abundance, permitted a new pattern of child rearing and an increase in the per capita birth rate. But also, agricultural societies needed these children because they needed additional hands, additional labor service, in order to run the agricultural enterprise itself. In most agricultural societies, the family and the workers within the family, men, women, and children, were essential to maintain the farming operation. Okay, with this change in birth rate, obviously, the differentiation between men and women tended to increase. Women had additional periods in which they were carrying children, dealing with young children, responsible for upbringing, and it was difficult for them to continue to serve as a major economic supplier for the family, difficult though not always impossible. And men increasingly, in most agricultural societies, assumed the role of principal cultivator of the crucial food crops. This economic differentiation, responsible for patriarchy, was fundamental to the agricultural experience and, again, greatly differentiated it from what had gone before. Childhood, of course, also changed. In hunting and gathering societies, children had had relatively few functions until they reached their early teen years. In agricultural societies, childhood and work became closely associated, and the virtues enjoined upon children, including obedience, tended to follow this shift in role as well. Okay, so with the advent of agriculture, even though it occurs at different times in different places, one sees a different kind of human experience emerge, different sets of relationships between different parts of the human community. The advent of agriculture, including its messiness, its uneven adoption, and uneven chronology, the advent of agriculture raises some really interesting questions about human progress. The most tempting thing to say, and I think this comes through in a good bit of grade school stuff about basic human history, the most obvious thing to say is, well, with agriculture, human beings were poised for further progress. And in some senses, that may be so. But it's also crucial to recognize that agriculture brought with it a number of very clear liabilities. And a few historians have argued that with agriculture, a downward spiral was established for the human species that we're still engaged in today. I wouldn't press it that far, but it's worth thinking about. What were the drawbacks? Drawback number one, obviously, agriculture introduced new kinds of inequality into the human experience, particularly between men and women. Drawback number two, as human societies began to settle down into clustered communities, disease possibilities increased. So agricultural societies were exposed to more epidemic disease than hunting and gathering peoples were. Agricultural societies also, almost by definition, were capable of altering the local environment in ways that hunting and gathering societies could almost never do. They might have some impact on animal numbers, but fundamental ecological shifts really awaited the advent of agriculture. And in some early agricultural communities, environmental damage actually emerged quite quickly and in some cases actually destroyed the communities involved, at least in that particular region. So it's important to see downsides to agriculture, lest we adopt an unduly rosy, progressive view of human history. And it's important to realize that some of these downsides actually affected the willingness to adopt agriculture itself, which, as I said, was not exactly a uniform given in the human response. But agriculture clearly had a few advantages, and this is why it spread. One of its advantages, and one historian has